Votre radio Autre Culture, bonjour, émission également diffusée sur audiopeople.fr. Dans le cadre des Audio Days du 11 et 12 avril 2011 à Paris, nous recevons David Josephson. Vous savez, David Josephson, le célèbre concepteur de microphones de la société Josephson Engineering.
Thank you all for coming. I don't think we need so much PA, but I'm David Josephson from Josephson Engineering. We have been making microphones in California for about 20 years now, a little more. And we all have a wide range of experience with microphones of different kinds. We have our own impressions of them, how they can be used in different applications and what they are useful for and where we would choose one kind and not another kind. And there seems to be some sort of a conflict between the idea of measured specifications and our actual experience, our actual impressions of using a microphone in an actual space with an actual music or voice source. And there seem to be two groups of people almost, one that says, oh, you must measure the specifications according to some standard, and that will tell you everything. And another group of people says, you cannot trust anything you hear from those numbers. They mean nothing. And you can only use your own experience. And so the first group of people come to me and say, why is your noise level 11 dB and not 12? Or why is it not 10? I say, okay, and plus or minus how many dB is it at 8 kilohertz? Okay, we have answers for all these questions. And the other group of people says, what's it good for? And I have the same, okay, well, what kind of room is it? What kind of this? What kind of that? So over the years, I have been trying to find some combination, some mixture of numerical specifications, measurements, performance, and our real impression. And I have to be polite, I would say, to both groups of people and say, yes, this is part of your experience, this is useful, but the real truth, of course, is in between these two groups of people. And both aspects are very important in understanding what a given microphone might be useful for and what your experience might be. The big problem is that there is no measurement that can capture the essence of a microphone sound. We have some measurements. The other big problem is that all of the various microphone companies use different measurements, and we can't compare them. I'll be talking about those sorts of things and the sorts of measurements that we do use and what they mean. Sometimes you can learn something from the numbers that you see. Sometimes they are useless. Sometimes they are, I would say, a hopeful fiction. Sometimes they are a lie. And my goal in this presentation is to give you some tools, some information about these things so that you can make your own judgments. Of course, nothing is going to replace your own experience, but understanding what the numbers mean and being able to judge, and you can judge, whether it's nonsense or fraud or just hopefulness, all of those things are useful tools to have in your collection. So we have some so-called standards that are ways that the that microphones are measured. And in the beginning, we have the United States, German DIN. And in Europe and in the UK, the national broadcasting organizations, set standards by which a microphone could be measured. Well, this is interesting, but it says, all right, I have this one microphone. I'm going to measure the performance, and I'm going to say what the measurement is. It doesn't say anything about how the next one will be. You have 10 of them all the same. Are they all the same? So that's the all of the standards, all of the measurements come down to that question. There is a measurement, and there is a some sort of guarantee, some sort of commercial relationship that you have with the manufacturer, and you have to ask these questions. What are we really talking about? Today, we have the IEC, International Electrotechnical Commission, that publishes a standard. We have the Audio Engineering Society, which is working on microphone standards. I am the chairman of the AES Standards Working Group on microphones. We have been working for more than 15 years. We have developed some standards, such as the digital microphone interface was the product of our work. But we have a group. It's a very interesting discussion we have every year or twice a year. We have the chief engineers from Neumann and AKG and Scheps and Sony and a few other companies. And I ask at these meetings, or I used to ask, I don't anymore. I used to ask, is there any one of you that uses the international standard to measure and report the performance of your microphones? And the answer is always no, not one. Everyone uses maybe some parts. So what I would like to convey to you today is how you can find out what the numbers mean that you're seeing. Again, this is a measurement standard, not a performance standard. They claim that they have measured the performance of a typical microphone, usually. And then, of course, you have the idea of, okay, what about if it's, what legal right do you have if the microphone you get is completely different from what the measurement says? And the answer is, that's up to you. So we have some very basic electrical specifications, mostly of the interface between the microphone and your equipment. These things are fairly easy to measure, and people know them, and people can agree pretty much on such things as sensitivity. That is in millivolts per Pascal. What if you have the microphone in a certain sound field that is coming to the front of the microphone at a certain level, what is the output voltage? More than anything, today it determines what kind of preamp you're going to need. If it has a very high output level, the preamp will have to handle a high output level and not clip. If it has a very low output level, your preamp will have to have more gain in order to get the signal level that you need. That's also related to the noise level. What kind of noise does the microphone make by itself? You want to be very certain that it's quieter than the noise level in the room where you're recording. Then this is not necessarily a single number. We'll get to that. Impedance is sort of an old-fashioned idea from telephony, where we want to get the most power out of the microphone. For that purpose, we aren't so concerned anymore. But we are concerned with the characteristic of the impedance, whether the cable and the preamp are going to load down the microphone output or control the output at all. And how much power does the microphone require? If it's phantom power, what kind? Can the preamp supply the power that's required without running out? So for sensitivity, the standard measurement is millivolts per Pascal. There are, we can say, three families of microphone output levels: dynamic and modern ribbon mics, some older condenser mics with a transformer output have a sensitivity on the order of 1 to 3 millivolts per Pascal, and you need 50, 60 dB of gain typically to reach your plus 4 dBU level. Modern condenser microphones, most of them, have an output level of 10 to 20 millivolts per Pascal. You need less gain some very high output condenser microphones maybe as high as 50 or 60 millivolts per Pascal, and you need less gain, and you need a preamp that will handle almost line level. The physics of the microphone capsule are such that in most cases, the output of the actual transducer is typically on the order of 10 or 20 millivolts per Pascal, or even more, maybe 40. The transformer in condenser microphones is nearly always a step-down transformer. There is an impedance converter that drives the transformer, and the transformer changes the voltage down. And it also, by doing that, it changes the impedance down, and it provides more current to drive the line. So transformer versus transformerless is not just the sound of the transformer, it is whether you are getting additional current to push into the microphone line, which is sometimes very important. When we're talking about impedance, this is, as you know, the characteristic source impedance of the microphone, and it's easy to measure. You put a resistor across the output, and whatever resistor results in half the voltage, that's the impedance that the source is. If it's a 100 ohm output microphone and you put a 100 ohm load on it, the voltage level will drop by half, because half of it will be dissipated in the resistor and half in the source of the microphone. We don't usually operate the microphone that way. So the number by itself doesn't mean so much. And for that reason, most companies don't specify what the actual source impedance of their microphone is. They will instead tell you what the minimum load impedance is. At some impedance, and any level above that, the microphone will operate properly. It's usually 5 times or 10 times what the actual source impedance is. This is important if you are using a microphone that is feeding many inputs paralleled together. If each one is, say, 1K and you have 5 of them together, you're going to load the microphone more than it will take, usually. A little more important than the impedance number itself is the balance. You want both sides of the balance line to have exactly the same impedance. Otherwise, the preamplifier cannot do its job of reducing interference that might be coupled by the outside world into the microphone cable. Noise level is the area where the microphone manufacturers seem to have the most difference in these basic electrical specifications. We like to have a single number, or maybe 2 numbers, that tells us how noisy the microphone is. We will see that that's not very useful, but we do it anyway. The most common methods that we use are A-weighted and the former CCIR, which is now called ITUR BS-468. Normally, the A-weighted number is about 11 or 12 dB less than the ITU number. The standard says that you shall use the ITU number. No one, or very few, actually do. We recommend now that data sheets, if you're going to specify that, should have both numbers. The reason they're different is this measurement method. The A-weighted is an RMS average. It's a slow measurement that is supposed to measure, it was designed to measure how loud a sound is, how audible a sound is by itself. Am I talking loudly enough in the room? That's what you use A-weighting and slow RMS averaging. But that's not what we're measuring here. We're measuring noise. It could be just a hiss. It could be crackles and snaps, little impulse noises. That's why they developed the quasi-peak measurement. It's there to measure how annoying a sound is on top of the program. That's why we use it. If the microphone is behaving properly, there is this 11-12 dB difference between A-weighted and ITU. A common problem with cheap microphones is that they have crackling noises. The A-weighting doesn't even see it, doesn't measure them at all. The other problem is that we don't know anything about the spectrum of the noise. If it were all flat and uniform at all frequencies, yeah, a number would be fine. But it isn't, so we recommend instead that people report a noise spectrum, and you can get a lot more information about this. We'll get into why that is. Here are two microphones. Which one is quieter? The B microphone will probably show a lower number because there in the center of the spectrum, the noise level is lower, maybe 8 dBA or so. The A microphone will show a higher noise level, maybe 11 in the middle there. But because of the design of the microphone, and there are many microphones like this, where they're looking for a lower noise floor, lower noise number to put on their data sheet, they actually make the microphone capsule with a frequency response that's humped in the middle. And they scoop out the middle in the electronics. And the result is that you get, I don't know if this works here, you get this high rumble noise. Sounds like an earthquake or a train going by. But the middle range is still low. You also get a high hiss level. High rumble and hiss, but a lower number, which is the quieter microphone. So this is an example where you say, oh, the numbers mean nothing, the measurements mean nothing, but this microphone sounds louder, rumblier than the other one. If you have the right measurements, if you have a spectrum, then you can make sense of it. And so you go back to the manufacturer and say, please give me a noise spectrum, not just some numbers. The issue of microphone power is particularly a problem with inexpensive equipment. Phantom powered microphones have a standard specification that says that every microphone input on a mixing desk or something should be able to provide 10 milliamps of phantom power, 14 if it's shorted. The console makers don't like this because it means they need higher power resistors that are very precise. The standard says they should be measured, they should be matched to within 0.4%. In fact, they should be matched much tighter than that. Those resistors of sufficient power rating are quite expensive, and if you have a mixing desk with 50 pairs of them, that's a lot of current. So my friend Jörg Wuttke at Scheps published a paper on the feeble phantom, he calls it, because in fact many mixing desks will not supply the necessary amount of power. Maybe they will for one or two microphones at a time, but not for all. And we actually made some changes. We're in the process of making some changes to the 61938 standard that says you will inform buyers of your product if it doesn't, if it can't operate a standard microphone on each input, on all inputs at the same time, please let us know how many are possible. Then we get to the really interesting questions. The electrical responses that we've, electrical characteristics that we've been talking about so far, impedance and voltages and noise and current, they're fairly easy to measure. And there's really not an awful lot of confusion or question about them. The frequency response of the microphone is another story entirely. The microphone as a physical transducer behaves very differently in different directions. Even for an so-called omnidirectional microphone, any directional microphone behaves differently at different distances because the shape of the sound field arriving at the microphone is different, the response will be different. And it depends also on the geometry of the sound source. Is it a point source like a mouth or an artificial mouth so small? Is it a piano? Is it the whole reverberant environment of a room? All of these things produce a completely different frequency response. And then again, there's the question of tolerance. So we say the microphone has this frequency response at some standard direction How sure are we that it's going to be the same for the next one in the box? Sometimes the makers will tell you that, sometimes they won't. Sometimes they will tell you that for the easy directions, like straight in front of the microphone. Will they tell you whether it's that way in the back of the microphone? We make all of our own microphone capsules and internal elements of the microphones in our shop in California. But there are many other microphone capsule makers in the world, and they often send me some samples to say, oh, we'll have a look at our wonderful things. And one group of five capsules arrived. I didn't ask for them, but they said, oh, here, they're wonderful. You should see these curves. They're so excellent. Each one matches very, very nicely, in fact, in the front. But the response in the rear varied by 15 dB from one to the next. One of them was about minus 12 or minus 14 in the null. The other one, the next one, was minus 30. I said, okay, I'll have some of those, but not any of those. And, of course, the curve was very different in the rear. So the manufacturers will only supply this information if you demand it. Smoothing is another big issue when they give you the frequency response curve. The real curve has some dips and wobbles in it. Some of them are the result, I would say, in fact, most of them are the result of errors in the measurement. But some of them are part of from the microphone, and you have the responsibility for yourself to find out which is which. Here's one of the variations that we typically see in the low frequency response. We call it proximity effect. This is three curves from the same microphone. The curve measured according to the standard would be the A picture. And it has a relatively uniform roll-off to, say, minus 3 dB at, what is it, about 40, 50, 45 hertz, something like that, minus 10 dB at 20. But at 20 centimeters, there is this fairly uniform corner frequency where it begins to roll up. And at 20 centimeters, it's up 4 dB. At 5 centimeters, it's up 8 dB. This relationship of proximity to boost and the corner frequency is something you want to know about, because it's very different from microphone to microphone, and it is not related directly to just the pattern. There are many other internal physical constants of the microphone that determine these things. And as you know, proximity effect is not only this bass boost, but also as you get further away, the bass rolls off. There is a point that we call the far field, or the plane progressive wave condition, typically about a wavelength away from the sound source, from a point sound source, where further distance does not create further roll-off. But very few people actually use the microphones at those distances. The international standard, by the way, says that's the only way to measure a microphone, is in the far field or plane progressive wave conditions. The thing to remember about proximity effect is that there isn't any for sounds arriving from the side of a pressure gradient microphone. And the reason for that is that there is no difference in time between the sound arriving from the front and the back of the microphone. Proximity effect is because of this distance between the front and the back. The mid-range and high-frequency characteristics of the microphone are a little easier to measure, because there aren't so many differences in response due to direction and distance. Changes in the mid-range response are usually connected with the diaphragm resonance itself, with the way that the pressure gradient is established, the venting from the side and back of the microphone. All of those physical constants determine what the mid-range response will be. The high-frequency responses are often due to what is correctly called scattering. Some people call it diffraction. It isn't really diffraction. Diffraction is a case of scattering, but there are all sorts of other things. When the sound arrives at the front of the microphone, and because of the given size, doubles the pressure, That's a scattering effect, not a direction, not a diffraction effect. Various other things that are happening inside the microphone capsule having to do with reflections of sound waves inside both the front and the back of the microphone determine the high frequency characteristics. And we are still only talking about on-axis anechoic response, that is, without any of this reflection or that reflection or other things that you find in the real world. Here are some examples. These are two different microphones, but on axis, they measure the same. Let's say that these measure the same. The A curve is what each of these microphones would measure, say, a meter away from a point source. Everything is very nice. It is not quite 4 dB of rise and behaves very nicely. Which one is the better microphone? B and C are the response curves at 180 degrees toward the back of the microphone. The B microphone does not attenuate as much, and we might want it to, but in this case it's only, 18 dB in the mid-range. But the attenuation extends lower, and that might be very useful, and extends higher, so that the high frequencies coming from the back are also attenuated. The C microphone, this is more common of older types, in fact, has more of a null mid-range, but at low frequencies, it's almost an omni. At high frequencies, because of the scattering, the response might be almost the same as on-axis. The reason this is a problem is that if you're trying to eliminate the sound from some instrument next to you, and there isn't any attenuation for high and low frequencies, what you have is this EQ curve applied to the sound coming from there, which is not exactly what you had in mind usually. Then we have the characteristics that don't really ever show up on data sheets because they are in the time domain rather than steady state conditions. These are mostly issues at the very high frequencies. Reflections internally from the grill or the basket of the microphone. Sometimes microphone companies use resonator to make the high frequency response stronger, more uniform, and indeed the amplitude response can be flatter, but the result might very well be that there are reflections inside that completely destroy the phase response. While they're doing that, it's unavoidable. But you want to know about these things, and you can often find some of this information hidden in the curve if the curve is good enough. These are two microphones. Curve A is the same sort of standard microphone we looked at before, and there's no resonator, and the high frequency response is fairly smooth up here. Suppose we say, no, we don't want it to be down so much. We don't want it to be minus 2 dB at 18 kilohertz. We want a lot of good response out here at 20 or so. For some reason, people are more into numbers, some of them. So the company will add a resonator, a little disc in front of the microphone, or a plate with holes in it, or something like that. The actual response, if you measure it carefully, is this blue B curve. There is this huge peak and a dip, and another peak. That's not avoidable. You will sometimes find that the diaphragm of the microphone is recessed a little bit from the front. So there's kind of a little echo chamber in there, a little funnel. Or there's a plate on top, something. The result is always a little boost in the high frequencies. What happens is that the much higher frequencies drop off much more steeply. The regular one will drop off more slowly. And there will always be this kind of ringing. They will almost always produce a kind of a harsh or sizzly sound. But if you want more high frequency extension, that's often the only way you can get it. All microphone designs are a compromise of many different things. So you want to ask the microphone company, how much smoothing is being used here? Are we just seeing 1/3 octave data or half octave or even 1 octave smooth data, nice smooth curve? Or can we really see what's going on here? And unfortunately, most of the companies will say, we don't know, or we won't tell you, or that's the basic presentation that I have. All of these curves were very recently published in an article in Resolution Magazine, this last issue, and some of these comments. I have some other comments in there, and there will be a copy of this PowerPoint and so on at this web address if anyone is interested. And I'm available for any kind of question that people might have about these specifications or how they're measured or anything like that. So up to you.
You were talking about the phase response.
Yeah.
But the curves are never published.
That's right.
So what can you consider about it? Are they supposed to be very linear or not?
They can't be. Unfortunately, they can't be. Phase response is a really good question, and we can talk about that. There are almost two different kinds of performance that you can measure. One is for a microphone that has one sound input, and you can model it as a two-port system, an in and an out. The other is for a microphone that has more than one. And in that case, the phase response will be very much more complex because it depends on what direction the sound is coming from. There is no standard method for measuring, not even a suggestion of a standard measurement for measuring phase response for directional microphones. You can say, okay, we measure it on axis with a standard source. Is that useful? Frankly, I don't think so. What is useful and what gives you information on the phase response is the whole time domain response. If you can look at the waterfall response of the microphone from a spark source or referenced a microphone whose resonance is completely out of band or something like that, you can get some information. But there is no good way to measure phase response by itself. And it's important. Fortunately for us, in real-world situations, it does not cause so much trouble because you have a reverberant sound field that is mixed in phase anyway. Other questions?
Considering the figure of eight microphone, what are the principal goal when we construct that sort of microphone because of the symmetrical problems that we could only consider with ears, because it's never written anywhere. The fact that coming from the left or the right to the capsule, you don't have the real symmetry.
Why wouldn't you have the... I don't understand the question.
When using some MS system, for example, with a figure of eight, it's really difficult to find a microphone which is really symmetrical and provide the same level from the right or the left of this capsule. I was only wondering about where is the clue point of the construction in that microphone to provide a good symmetry.
It is perhaps one of the most difficult requirements in making a microphone capsule, a figure eight capsule, to be symmetrical front and back. Ours match within about 0.25 dB. Other companies might be much, much worse than that. And the reason is that it requires very precise matching of two completely different acoustical systems. Even if you have a symmetrical system like the Sennheiser types with one diaphragm and two backplates, each of those spacings, each of those acoustic spaces on either side of the diaphragm is an independent device. And matching the resonance, the compliance, the resistance damping of each side is going to be completely different. So in theory, you should be able to say, show me the polar diagram and let's look and see what is the difference front from one side to the other. They're not so happy to give you that information usually, but it is that information is there, and as you say, it's very important. You should ask for it. The matching is important. This also determines how uniform any pattern that you derive from the figure eight will depend on that. So you can measure this. the standard that we are trying to have everyone agree on in the AES, we have the IEC standard, which shows us some measurement methods. And unfortunately, it is much too broad. You can make many different kinds of measurements, and they will all be sort of compliant with the IEC standard. In the AES Standards Committee project X85, we are trying to develop a higher level that will have a fairly uniform, you can say, a subset of the IEC measurements. And one of those will be a family, one sheet with a family of frequency curves, on axis at 180 degrees, so the other side of the figure eight, on axis in the null if it's different from 180 degrees, like at a hypercardioid, and at, I think, 10 or 15 degree intervals. Instead of trying to make a polar diagram, which doesn't tell you very much, a frequency response at a bunch of different distances. We also, of course, want the frequency content of the noise on the same curve. So we are working on that, being able to present that information in that way. Other questions?
Can you talk to us a bit about the effects of placing a microphone capsule on the surface of a sphere, please?
Mm-hmm. Any time you have some physical body that reacts with the sound field, there will be a change in the actual sound field at the boundary of that body and at some distance away. Again, some people call it diffraction. In fact, it's properly called scattering, because what we're talking about is the reaction of the sound wave that's moving in air, and the air has one characteristic impedance, and it hits a solid object, or mostly solid, it has another characteristic impedance, so the wave is scattered. That translates some of the volume velocity of the wave to pressure. So at any surface, the pressure will be increased, and that increase varies with frequency. As long as the surface is large with respect to the wavelength, there will be a boost of as much as 6 dB. There are many works out there that have modeled the behavior of spheres and cylinders and various other shapes. And with an omnidirectional microphone, it's fairly easy to calculate what the resulting response will be. It's just the scattering of that body. And that can be used for a number of things. If the body is 40, 50 millimeters, as in the Neumann M50 or other things of that sort, you find that you have some pressure doubling at higher frequencies. Typically, we look for 2 or 3 dB, maybe a little less at 10, 15 kilohertz. And there is a corresponding reduction because of the shadowing. If the sound is arriving from the back, some of it will scatter around and follow the sphere, and some of it won't. This is a case where modeling the theory actually results in approximately how it is. In the case of like the Scheps sphere or other larger baffles, it's exactly the same, but beginning at a lower frequency. And it's useful for shadowing the microphone the way the head shadows microphones. So it's this is all fairly well modeled in the theory, and the actual performance responds exactly for that for omnidirectional microphones. For directional microphones, it's a completely different story, because you don't know what recipe is being used by that particular directional capsule, because you will scatter and pressure boost the response for the front. You will also be doing it for sounds arriving for the side and the rear in that direction, and that may have very different effects on the directional response, frequency response.
Hello, you have mentioned several times the difficulty to obtain some regularity over a series of same microphone, if I understood well. From your point of view, to go to this direction of having a good regularity, do you obtain better result with some very automated and industrial production way, or by a very artisanal, I mean, with a human intervention and human fine-tuning of the equipment?
It depends on how many you want to make. I started making all of my capsules myself, personally, by hand. Some capsules take 1 or 2 hours, some of them take 1 or 2 days, sometimes longer. It is really, it depends on how well the microphone maker understands the underlying physics. If you know, in setting the manufacture of a particular capsule, there are hundreds of dimensions that have some arbitrary tolerance. If all of the dimensions are identical, then the response of the microphone will be identical. And you say, okay, suppose I have a spacing from the diaphragm to the back plate of 10 or 20 microns. And I say, okay, I'm going to make this so that it is within 1 micron. And it does not have any it's flat within a tenth of a micron. And this results in a certain number. And I can make them all like that. Then it's a matter of asking your machinist how tightly he can control these things. Where in the practical world, what comes out is that the manufacturer decides what level of performance is good enough to sell. And that determines how long he will take doing it by hand, or how much precision he will put into the automated machinery. We find in our production, we make a little less than 1,000 microphones a year. It is a mixture of those things. Some things are very easy to get absolutely precise with automated processes. Some things require hand intervention, artisanal, as you say, work. And that's one of the real secrets in the microphone manufacturer's mind. Where do you put your energy? Which of these things is more important? You cannot. Every microphone is a combination of automated things and handwork. Where do you put your energy? Which one of these processes? And ultimately, in my practice, other companies have different ideas, but I have to measure the results of every one of these things. And I try to make a correlation between the actual response, both the measured response and the ear response. We, in my company, all of us have been recording engineers for a long time. Some of us are musicians. We're very, very critical about the sound of things. So we have to make this balance. We're always trying to make a correlation between the manufacturing process, the measured response, and the human response. And we have a lot of arguments about this. So there is no one answer.
Can you talk a bit about transformer versus transformer-less microphones, pros and cons, sound differences, and what you personally prefer and choose for your microphones? Thanks.
Well, we do both. And the transformer is the output stage of the microphone, is the interface between the microphone and the rest of the world. Transformers do some things very well. You get a bass roll-off for free that's fairly well constrained. Unfortunately, the output of a transformer microphone is now not a pure resistive impedance. It's reactive because of the inductance and the capacitance of the transformer windings. So the microphone will react differently with different cables and different preamps that it might not do if it were transformerless. Most of our microphones are transformerless. They are a direct symmetrical emitter follower on each of the output legs for Phantom. And that's a really clever design. I can't improve very much on that. It was developed by Billy Kusters at Scheps many years ago, and everyone has copied it. It works well if you take particular care with the selection of the components. It's not, the transistors are not operating in a range that you normally expect, because the output stage of a microphone typically has zero gain. We're not using that as a voltage amplifier, but only as a line driver impedance amplifier. The transformer has its own sound. because of the reactances that are part of it. So, for example, our C7, our E22S microphone, which is intended for very loud close-up pickup, drums, horns, guitar cabinets, has a special transformer made for us by Lundahl with an amorphous metal glass core that has a very linear transfer function. But it still has a very strong current amplifying a characteristic, as it is the ratio of the transformer is 4:1. So the voltage is knocked down by a factor of 4, that's 12 dB. And the impedance, output impedance, and the current, the impedance goes down, the current goes up. The amount of current that's available to push into the line is significantly increased. And that's good, because we are operating in a condition where the amount of power available from Phantom is very limited. And if we're interested in getting our signal through the line with minimum effect, then a transformer output can be very good for that. I made the design of that transformer, the requirements, design requirements of that transformer, available to four of the biggest, best transformer companies in the world: Jensen, Cinemag, Haufe, and Lundahl. And only one company was able to make the transformer that would do what I wanted to and fit inside that little tube. So there are some very strong requirements of such a thing. It's also a very, very expensive part. So it's hard to make a good transformer output. It is possible. And in our other, our 715 microphone, for example, we use a much larger Lundahl transformer that is a nickel core and much more traditional sort of approach, for the same sort of reason. We want it to be able to work with just about any preamp at high levels and not have any distortion. That said, if the preamp is going to be a known thing, I don't want the sound of a transformer in some sorts of characteristics. So our C700 series, our C42, the 617 Precision Omni are transformerless, and they use a very carefully matched pair of PNP emitter followers that drive the line by, you can say, brute force. It draws almost 6 milliamps from phantom power. And for example, with the 617, the output level may be as much as 60 or 65 millivolts per Pascal. That requires a lot from the phantom supply that the transformer-equipped microphone wouldn't. So again, every decision that you make in designing a microphone is a compromise. We like them both. That's why we make models with both transformers and transformerless. Other questions?
Do you plan to do a digital AES-42 microphones?
That's an interesting question.
Because you're the head of the work group.
I have been working on that standard now for almost 15 years. It has been working since that long. I have put all of this energy into this standard, arguing with people like Neumann and Sennheiser and processing companies and the mixing console people. We had an awful lot of work. I can say that I did some of the organizing, but there was a lot of good technical work by a lot of people in that standard. The reason I did that is that I have some ideas for a digital microphone. I will not make a digital microphone that is an analog microphone with an analog to digital converter in it, like everyone has already. I know enough, I don't know very much, but I know enough about the characteristics of the normal condenser microphone capsules that I think we are pretty close to as good as that can be. I have some ideas, and some other people do too, for microphones that are inherently digital. They make a digital bitstream output as a result of their function, and there might not even be a backplate. There might not even be the sort of structure that we know today. There are all kinds of ways of doing that. And my thinking was that if we have some work over the years on a digital microphone interface, when my technology is ready, then I will have something to plug it into. That's the reason. Thank you very much. I'm here today and tomorrow.
Bientôt en ligne, la deuxième partie de la conférence de David Josephson. Autre radio, autre culture. Au revoir. Autre radio, autre culture.